All right, welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is away this week. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. That's radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. All right, so these are, I have a series now on the six basic principles of naturopathic medicine. This week, we talk about number six, prevention. What does prevention mean? Well, in naturopathic medicine, of course, we want to prevent conditions from happening before they happen. So that's a basic idea. So how you prevent conditions from happening is, there's a lot of ways to do that. One is that you assess a person and see if they have a family history of any illnesses. So if there's a serious condition that happens in a family, you want to screen that person or at least be watching out to see if that person comes down with signs of that condition or see if they have, do tests to see if they have markers for that condition. So for example, if you're in your family, you know that your mother and your aunt and your grandmother, your maternal grandmother, all are hypothyroid, you might want to watch out to see if you become hypothyroid. And then you might want to find out if that if the people in that family have an autoimmune thyroid condition. So, for example, do they have Graves' disease or do they have Hashimoto's thyroiditis? And Hashimoto's thyroiditis is an autoimmune thyroiditis where you have a genetic predisposition to have antibodies, part of the immune system, going after the thyroid gland and making it harder for you to make thyroid hormone and also to make both T4 and T3, the less active and more plentiful form, and the more active but the form of thyroid hormone that your body makes judiciously because it's so potent. So you want to be monitoring that person at least yearly, if not more, and also symptomatically to see if they have signs of hypothyroidism. And so that you can, and there are things you can do to prevent hypothyroidism from happening, like eating adequate iodine, detoxification regularly, having a lifestyle where you don't take on too many toxins, reducing stress. Stress can aggravate any condition, so helping a person to reduce their stress can prevent any condition from coming on, or at least help with that. Checking to make sure that the person is getting adequate nutrition that supports the thyroid gland directly, that they're getting enough iodine, they're getting enough vitamin B6, they're getting enough selenium, and they're getting trace minerals in their diet, and they're not overdoing things like sugar or alcohol. You want to make sure that their liver is functioning well because a good bit of conversion of T4 to T3, the activation of T4 to its more active form T3, happens in the liver. So if you have a good functioning liver, you're going to do that better. If you're drinking too much alcohol, if you're eating too much sugar, if you're exposed to environmental toxins, that's going to be more difficult. So you want to work on prevention that way. Cardiovascular disease is a big one. If there's cardiovascular disease in your family, there are many things you can do to reduce your cardiovascular risk, and they range from eating a very healthy diet, eating the Michael Pollan-style diet, which is eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Whether you're vegan or paleo or vegetarian, there's a lot of markers that you can check for cardiovascular disease. There's a lot of neat things that have come out in recent years for screenings for cardiovascular disease, especially in the area of cardiovascular inflammation. So you can get your doctor to check for those markers. And if you have markers for inflammation, even though you have no signs of cardiovascular disease, you can help start working on those markers for inflammation. For example, it's easy now to get a test for oxidized LDL. So LDL, if it's elevated, your low-density lipoprotein, which is the protein that carries cholesterol from your liver to the body for use. If LDL is just floating around and it's big and puffy and buoyant and it's not sticking to your arteries and it's not oxidized, it's not going to really hurt your arteries. And so you can test to see if your LDL is oxidized. And if you do have some level of oxidized LDL, then you can go on a program of reducing inflammation and increasing the antioxidants in your diet. And if you do that, you might you might do better in preventing irritation, damage, and inflammation to your arteries. So to reduce your oxidized LDL, it's real easy to get a test for that now. It used to be only specialty labs did it, and there wasn't good access to it and good insurance coverage for it, and now there is. So that's something you can do. If you know you have a family history of cardiovascular disease, you want to find the right exercise for you, good cardiovascular exercise, and not to excess. You want to get the right amount of cardiovascular exercise. But, for example, if you have a history of cardiovascular disease, doing very long cardio might not be the best thing for you. So there's questions about whether running marathons are good for your cardiovascular health, for example. And the way to do that is if you're a runner and you're trying to prevent cardiovascular health, what you do is you go to your friendly local naturopath or your friendly holistic cardiologist, and you get tested for those inflammatory markers before you ever have a problem. And then you see if those are present. And if they are, doesn't necessarily mean you have to stop training for your marathons, but you might want to do some work around taking antioxidants and making sure that you work on getting those markers down. Antioxidants can be a big help for that. So getting a moderate amount of cardio and just keeping those markers in check can be a really good thing. If you're not getting any exercise, that's not good for cardiovascular disease. So obviously, cardiovascular health is a move it or lose it phenomenon. If you use your heart and you use your blood vessels, you're going to be less likely to have cardiovascular damage. Just the way it works, it's you got to flush out the pipes to keep them clear. So you're going to prevent cardiovascular disease by regularly flushing out the pipes. And what that literally means, it means a number of things, that concept of flushing out the pipes. When you exercise, you're cycling your blood through your body many more times than if you were just sitting still, because you're raising your heart rate. You're also increasing the efficiency of your heart. Exercise is a positive inotrope. What that means is that when you get regular exercise, your heart becomes more efficient. That is, your heart pumps out more blood per beat than if you did not exercise. So that means with each beat, you get more blood going everywhere. And why is that good? Because blood has good stuff in it. Blood has, obviously, it has iron in it, and iron has a lot of oxidative capacity. So what it does is it carries oxygen to every cell in your body, everywhere, your brain, your heart, your lungs, all of your organs, all of your muscles, all of your tissues. Well, not all of your tissues, because some of your tissues, it's indirect, like your joints. The synovium doesn't have a blood supply. Your cartilage doesn't have a blood supply. But you know, it gets the benefit of fluid that comes out of the blood and then enters it. So you get nutrition everywhere. You know, if there was no communication between your joints and your blood supply, glucosamine sulfate wouldn't work to rebuild your joints. So there is communication. It's just not, it's indirect. It's from the, from fluid leaving the blood and going to bathe the synovium. Anyway, so when you get exercise, you're sending blood everywhere in your body, at a much higher rate. And so more blood is going per beat. And when you're increasing your heart rate, that blood is seeing all of your tissues many more times. So if there's good stuff in it, if you're putting antioxidants in, if you're eating your fruits and vegetables, if you're taking supplements that have good things for your heart, some good antioxidant supplements like vitamin C, vitamin E, mixed carotenoids, lutein, zeaxanthin, lycopene, all that good stuff, you're going to shore up the strength of all of your blood vessels, and you're going to reduce oxidative damage. And the other thing that's going on is when your body sees that you are using your body for exercise, that you're cycling your blood through your liver a lot more, it goes ahead and produces more HDL. That's high density lipoprotein. And I'm assuming that it does that as a response to the fact that there's so much more circulation happening. And when you raise that HDL, the HDL is going to run around and pick up cholesterol that could be hanging out in your blood vessels waiting to patch up a clot or waiting to patch up a damaged spot. So when you have more HDL, HDL is cardioprotective and it keeps your arteries clearer. So when you get that exercise, you are preventing cardiovascular disease. And if you're not exercising, if you walk into a naturopath's office and you tell the naturopath, I'm not exercising, one of the things we're going to do is we're going to try to figure out a way to get you moving. And if you're like, but I have this knee, but I have this foot, but I have this hip, then we're going to take however many steps back we have to take to get you to a place where you can move and find a way that you can move. And if you're like, well, I can't move, well, let's figure out a way you can move. Most people can do something in water. And that's one of the things that we try to recommend. If you're having trouble walking or getting on a bike or doing something on land, you can often do something in the water because the water is so forgiving. And it's a great way. You can get into a hot tub, you can get into a pool, and you can do exercises, whether you swim laps or whether you just do range of motion exercises and stretching in the water. It's so lovely and forgiving to do that. I can do yoga stretches in the water that I can't hope to do on land just because of the balance. And so, you know, at the end of my swims, I will generally tend to grab the side of the pool, and I will be able to I'll be able to stand, and I'll do dancer, and I'll do different neat stretches, and it'll be really great. And so I do recommend doing that. Stretching in the water is just awesome. So in naturopathic medicine, we want to help you to assess conditions that you may be predisposed to and find ways to take steps back to look at how you can live a lifestyle to prevent that condition from happening. So that's prevention at the personal level. Prevention in naturopathic medicine isn't just about the personal level. It also happens to be about the community level. If you live in a community that is not healthful, that doesn't have resources for you to be healthy, you have no place to go and exercise, you don't have green spaces, you don't have access to healthy, nutritious food, that's a problem. If the environment, if you have climate change for the worse, if you have pollution, those are all things that's part of naturopathic prevention. So naturopathic physicians are very interested in the environment. If there's environmental toxins around you, whether they're outgassing from plastics, from things that you buy, or whether it's or whether you live near a generation station or an oil refinery, where unfortunately around oil refineries and around coal burning plants, there are much higher rates of cancer, unfortunately, and lung diseases and things like that. And so that's an issue. So working on getting the environmental toxins down from the environment is very important. That's part of what we are interested in naturopathic medicine. Prevention is not just, you know, preventing specific conditions, but helping you with stress reduction. You've often heard me say that one of the main things that I treat in naturopathic medicine is stress. It really is, because stress can help fix anything. I have people come in who have cancer. If you can reduce your stress, your immune system will work better. I have people who come in who have asthma. Well, of course, you're going to have more asthma attacks if you're under stress. I have people who come in with GI stuff. You better believe it. You have all the same nerves and neurotransmitters in your gastrointestinal system as you do in your brain and your central nervous system. It's interesting because it's the same neurotransmitters and the same kinds of nerves. So if you have digestive upset, if you have a direct digestive upset, so say you you ate a food that didn't work for you and it aggravated your gastroesophageal reflux because it inflamed your stomach. That inflammation in your stomach is going to cause a fight or flight response. You're going to release more stress hormones because of that. And that stress hormones are then, they're just going to go right into your blood and they're going to go to your brain, and your brain's going to look at it and go, oh, I'm stressed. And then your cortex, the part of you that thinks, is going to see those stress hormones and go, it's going to scan the radar for something to be upset about. And then you're going to get upset. Maybe you'll just get upset directly about your stomach, or maybe you'll get upset about that bad conversation you had with your girlfriend the other day. But you'll scan the radar for something to be upset about. It's really interesting. Of course, it goes the other way. If you want to have healthy digestion, you need to be in your autonomic nervous system. You need to be in rest and digest mode. And if you're in rest and digest, your digestion is going to work better. If you're in fight or flight, those neurotransmitters are then going to go to your digestive system and they're going to slow it down. They're going to kind of shut it down because it's not as important for you to digest your food as it is for you to run away from the bear. And your autonomic nervous system, of course, doesn't know the difference between running away from the bear and I'm upset and I have, I'm upset about this thing that's going on. You know, I have this work deadline or my kid needs a change. My kid's yelling or that argument you had with your boyfriend the other day. So your body doesn't know the difference between that. So you release these stress hormones and it slows down your digestive system. If you have a pre-existing digestive condition, or if you're just prone to, your stress goes right to your digestive system, you getting upset is going to cause that. So anything that I can do to help direct you to reducing stress is going to help your digestive system. Cardiovascular system as well. The cardiovascular system is directly affected by whether you're in fight or flight or rest and digest, because your cardiovascular system has to rev up to get moving, to get blood everywhere so you can run away from that bear. Of course, usually there's no bear, although they're becoming more prevalent here in Connecticut. You know, people are coming home and finding their houses, turned over and all kinds of food spread all over the place because it's been searched through by bears. Interesting stuff. So sometimes you might have to run away from a bear around here. But anyway, stress reduction is a form of prevention. So prevention in naturopathic medicine is about assessing conditions that you may have and that you're predisposed to and helping you to live a healthier lifestyle with reduced stress. It's also about healing the environment. So that means that naturopathic physicians, to varying degrees, are going to be interested in healing the environment, and they're going to be interested in things like climate change, in reducing pollution, and also in the political situation. Of course, we're interested in politics because we want naturopathic medicine to be accessible to everyone, because we still have many states where naturopathic medicine isn't licensed, and we still have the situation in Connecticut where we are not allowed to do all the things we're trained to do, like prescribe pharmaceuticals and minor surgery and deliver babies if we have the extra training, to deliver IVs. We can break the skin for diagnostic purposes, but we can't break the skin for therapeutic purposes. So I can tell you that you have pernicious anemia, that you have an autoimmune condition that doesn't allow you to effectively absorb your vitamin B12. I've been trained to give you an injection of vitamin B12, which will circumvent your ability to absorb it. And I'm not allowed to do that in Connecticut. But if I cross the border, cross a couple of borders into New Hampshire, and I get a New Hampshire license, all of a sudden I'm allowed to do it. So we wish that would change. We have a very old, arcane law, and we've been working endlessly at trying to get this law changed. Big shout out to my buddy Rick Leva, who's a naturopathic physician who's been practicing for many years in Middletown, Connecticut, and all of his coordinating efforts to get the law changed. He's working on it tirelessly, and he continues to do so. So big shout out to Rick Leva. Okay, so that's prevention. Prevention, like I said, it's about helping you to assess conditions that you may have and to prevent them from happening in the first place, and also helping you to live in an environment and in a world that is healthful so that you can have the resources that you need, so you can have good farmers markets, good farms, that you don't live in food deserts, that we can do something about changing the fact of food deserts, so that we can clean up the environment, so that you can breathe clean air, so that the environment is a healthy place to live, so that there are green spaces for you to go and you have access to these places. So that's principle number six, the idea of prevention. There are some corollary ideas in naturopathic medicine, which I will perhaps get to. So we've done the six basic principles of naturopathic medicine. The healing power, let's see if we can rattle them off. Healing power of nature, first do no harm, look for the cause, treat the whole person, doctor is teacher, and prevention. Whoa, I did it. Okay. And so there are some other principles that we talk about in naturopathic medicine. There's some are related to homeopathy. For example, Herring's Law, that you treat the person. The healing happens from top to bottom, from most important to least important organs, and from inside outside. So that's something we can talk about. Another one I really like to talk about is removing obstacles to cure. So, and that's probably a corollary to some of the others, but we'll get to that in upcoming weeks. Big shout out today. It's Jerry Garcia's birthday. Let me find out how old he would have been. Jerry Garcia. Yeah, I didn't look to see when he was born. So his birthday, he was born in 1942. So he would have been 76 today. Yeah, so big shout out to Jerry. Shake it, sugary. Just don't tell them that you know me. All right, that was a little shout out to Jerry. I don't want to sing too much because then we have copyright issues. But anyway, so happy birthday, Jerry. You wake up to find out that you are the eyes of the world. All right, so let's talk about some other stuff. So update on my knee. Let me check the bursitis. You know, I think my knee is getting better and better. I was just so afraid that was it, that my knee was just, that was it. I was going to have a terrible riding season. I wouldn't be able to ride anymore. But I have been a good girl, and I have been backing off on my riding. I have not been riding more than, say, 55 miles, and only once a week. And the rest of the week when I ride, I don't push as hard. I haven't been doing intervals, and I have been resting more, and I've been wearing athletic tape almost constantly. I've had this iteration of athletic tape on for way too many days, and it's kind of funny because it's falling off, and I'm like, why don't I just pull it off and let Ron do it later? But we haven't gotten around to it, and I'm like, some is better than none. So it's pretty funny. I'm walking, so if you see me walking around with athletic tape hanging off me, you can laugh at me. It's really fine. And the other thing is that the extreme tape, that's extra sticky, that allows you to swim without it falling off right away. I mean, it will fall off after about 4 or 5 days, but it does allow you a couple of days of good support. So it comes in black, and the other color it comes in is black, and also it comes in black. So I can't get flesh tone, I can't get pink, I can't get pretty colors. The pretty colors, you can get the pro stuff, and that comes in pretty colors, but the extreme, if you want extreme, it comes in black, and also black. It's very nice. But it is great stuff, I must say. I'm very impressed with Kinesio tape. Any kind of tape that you get, it's just amazing, because it just keeps the tendons in line, and it makes it so that you can continue to move, and it definitely reduces pain. You can have a part that is hurting you, and you put the tape on, and then it stops hurting. It's amazing. So I'm a person who, I can't take NSAIDs. If I take aspirin or ibuprofen, or other, I took magnesium salicylate once. If I take enough of those substances to give me pain relief, they upset my stomach. So I can't take them. So my anti-inflammatories have to be things like fish oil, vitamin B6, magnesium. All those things have to help. My knee is much better. And I think it's just time. It's just time and not pushing it too hard. It's really quite something. So I've been continuing to get acupuncture and chiropractic and using the tape and taking it easy. And that's mostly what I've been doing. I do have a home small low-level laser that I haven't been using consistently. I've also been using, homeopathic gel. And that has numerous homeopathic levels of things like arnica and rutagraviolins and restox. So a bunch of homeopathic remedies that are really good for tendons and nerves and things like that. So I've been using that. All right. So that's the update there. Let's see. So let's move on. Let's talk about a couple of conditions. There are a couple of conditions that are common in menopause. And so I wanted to bring those to you today. One of them is lichen sclerosis. And lichen sclerosis is really uncomfortable. I've had a number of women come in with this condition, and where they get it, unfortunately, is on their vulva. And so that makes it so that you're, first of all, you're just plain uncomfortable. If you've you've got this condition, usually it itches like crazy. And if it's present there, you can wind up having chafing, and that just makes the condition worse. Of course, one of the things that happens is for a number of reasons, when you are in menopause, intercourse becomes more painful or more difficult, that can become problematic. It doesn't always. Some women are very blessed in that they have no problems at all. But I have many women who come to me and they're like, well, I have vaginal dryness, or it hurts. So it really hurts to have intercourse. It's like sandpaper. They've got all these complaints because, unfortunately, with the withdrawal of hormones, you don't make as much lubrication, and the tissues aren't primed to handle the amount of trauma that you get when you have intercourse. So when you have lichen sclerosis, that makes the situation worse. And I'm seeing here that it's an uncommon condition. I don't know how uncommon it is, because it's so when people ask me, how often do you see something? Have you ever seen this condition before? I had a bunch of people come in with Crohn's disease in the last couple of weeks. And I had somebody ask me, how many times have you seen Crohn's disease? And I said, well, with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, you treat them similarly because they're both inflammatory bowel disease. I said to the young woman, well, it's not. So there are certain things you almost never see, and there are certain things you see every day. And inflammatory bowel disease is somewhere in between. I definitely have seen a lot of it over the course of my, naturopathic career, and it's 22 years I've been in practice. I want to say it's somewhere in the, it's the teens or 20s or 30s. Like, it hasn't been everybody, but it's certainly been enough for me to take notice and for me to have to help people with it regularly. Well, lichen sclerosis is starting to be kind of like that. It's not like I see it every day, but in the past few years, I feel like I've seen it more. And, maybe right now in my practice, there's 5 or 6 women who have it, which is that's not nothing. I mean, it doesn't sound like very much in the course of the number of patients, but it's enough for me to take notice and want to study up on it and to make sure that women are getting treatment for it. So what happens with lichen sclerosis? Like I said, often it happens on the vulva, and it can make intercourse uncomfortable, and it can make you itch like crazy. It's just uncomfortable whether or not you're having intercourse. So it can affect skin anywhere on your body, but usually it happens on your vulva. It can also happen on the foreskin of your penis, and it can also happen on the skin around your anus. But postmenopausal women, yay us. We're at higher risk for it. So that makes me think that there is a hormonal component to it. And I have, in fact, had some women try to treat it using hormones, using topical estriol. And so some women have success with that and some don't. Sometimes lichen sclerosis just goes away and you won't need any treatment. But what some women just need to have treatment. And unfortunately, lichen sclerosis can scar. You can get this inflammation and then it can scar you. And what's the hard about scarring, when you have scar tissue is inactive tissue. It's just fibrotic tissue that doesn't do what the tissue around it is supposed to do. So it doesn't have glands in it. It doesn't make lubrication. It doesn't have sensation. So you want to avoid scarring. So lichen sclerosis, like I said, can make you itch a lot. It can make you uncomfortable and have pain. It can give you white spots on your skin. It can give you wrinkly patches. And it can also make you bruise easily or even tear. And you can also bleed or blister or have lesions, and they can get infected. And, of course, it can give you painful intercourse. So how you tend to treat lichen sclerosis, they don't know exactly what causes it. I really think that there's a hormonal imbalance component to it, that, as your hormones decline, our estrogen and progesterone, you're more likely to get it, because you see it a lot in perimenopausal women. You generally do not see it in women who haven't had their menopause yet. It's not contagious because it's it's an inflammatory condition. It's not caused, as far as we know, it's not caused by a virus. So it can't be spread. It's you're not going to pass it on to your partner. It can occur, but it can occur in anyone. It actually can occur in anyone of any age. And it's interesting because it tends to affect your vulva. So it'll affect your labia majora or your labia minora. In boys and men, it tends to happen more in the foreskin than anywhere else. So if you're uncircumcised, you're more likely to get it. If you're circumcised, you're probably not going to get it, which is interesting. You can also get it if you're a child, if you're prepubescent. So this is interesting to me. So you're more likely to get it if you're a kid, and you're more likely to get it if you're perimenopausal. So that says to me that reproductive hormones have a role in preventing it. Because if a kid has it and then they go through puberty and it goes away, that means now their reproductive hormones are on board and reproductive hormones are going to prevent it. So it's also rare, but can happen. The places where you have lichen sclerosis can become cancerous, but that is rare. So if you have lichen sclerosis, you are more likely to develop vulvar cancer. But if you consistently treat it, that can reduce that risk. And so treatment, usually how it's treated, when you get treatment, you're often going to be given topical steroids. That's generally how, the compounds that, MDs give usually have steroids in them, and they do suppress the inflammation. You have to be careful to use these because, unfortunately, corticosteroids, even though they are gonna suppress the inflammation and your lesions will probably go away, you're gonna be more likely to thin the skin. So I just want to shout out to everyone. Unfortunately, I'm flying solo today, so it is very difficult for me to answer the phone. I'm not going to be able to do that today because I can't screen your calls. So if you would like to ask a question, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and email me at radionaturopath @gmail.com, and I can answer your questions that way. And I see that nobody has as of yet. So yeah, please do that. I'm not going to be able to answer the phone, unfortunately, but thank you for calling. All right. So anyway, corticosteroid creams, as I said, so you can't use those indefinitely because they can cause thinning of the skin. And then you have other problems that if the skin is thin, then it is more friable. It's going to be more easy to bruise or break or tear. They also might offer immune modulating medications like tacrolimus and pimecrolimus, which are they are not steroids, but they are immune modulators. They are immunosuppressives, but they're not steroids. So, and then you can use ultraviolet light, but not for your genitals. So I don't know what would happen if you decided to sunbathe in the buff and, do a few, maybe 10 to 15 minutes of healthy ultraviolet light on your lichen sclerosis in the buff, in the areas where, and expose the areas where you have it. That might be just fine, and it might not be. But when they do ultraviolet light treatments, like if you go to a dermatologist and they do ultraviolet light treatments, they're going to generally only do that in the non-genital areas, like if you have it on your arms or you have it on your legs. Your reproductive tissue is going to be more sensitive to the ultraviolet light. So what do we do as naturopaths for this? Well, one of the things we do is we talk to you about your hormones. And depending on whether we decide that bioidentical hormones are right for you, that might be something we talk about. If you're wanting to do bioidentical hormones, then we would measure your hormone levels, your estrogen and your progesterone in particular, if you're a woman. And we would find out if you're low in those, and then we'd come up with some bioidentical hormone levels to offer you, whether we did creams or we did, oral. And I'd probably choose to do whole body where you ingested the bioidentical hormones. So if you did progesterone cream or if you did oral progesterone oil, likewise estrogen in cream or oil. I would also I would also like to see topical preparations of estriol applied directly to the lichen sclerosus, because if you're doing that, you want to get a preparation that is meant for vulvar use, because some preparations are, like, you can get estriol creams, but they're really not meant for placement on your vulva, but some are. And so estriol cream is something you can get over the counter. So there are basically three estrogens in our body. When you talk about estrogen, you're not talking about one compound. There's estrone, estradiol, and estriol. And when you are given estrogen by your gynecologist or by your physician, you're given estradiol. And the reason they do that is because it's quite potent and it's going to have an effect right away. Estriol is not as potent. Our bodies are very wise in that we tend to carry hormones in our body in proportions that are balanced. So if you overstimulate estrogen receptors with estrogen, they can overgrow and they can do things like at best overgrow tissue and at worst cause cancer. So if you did too much estradiol and you didn't balance out the estriol, you might be more at risk for cancer. So our bodies are very smart that way. So in our bodies, you know, in women's bodies, we have estrogen, and about 60 to 80% of it is estriol, and 10 to 20% of it is estradiol and estrone. And so estriol used topically, it's a nice way to go because it is the least potent of them. So you're like, well, if it's the least potent, why would you want to use that one? Because it's the least potent. The neat thing about applying estriol topically is it has a pretty short half-life when you apply it topically. So not too much of it gets into you, into your body. And so you can apply it topically and it's going to have a rebuilding effect on the local tissues, and you're not going to get too much absorption. And what does get absorbed is going to get broken down pretty quick. So there's a very, very low likelihood for it to do too much to the inside of your body. Like, if you want to have an estrogenic effect on the rest of your body, you have to take it another way. There's even recommendations for use of estriol on women who've had reproductive cancer, you know, to use it topically, that it's not going to increase your likelihood of having a recurrence. So it's pretty safe stuff. So that's one of the things that I like to recommend, topical estriol. Other things I've seen people use with success are topical preparations of gamma-linolenic acid. So GLA is in high levels in evening primrose oil and in borage oil. It's also in blackcurrant oil, but just the yield is lower, but it definitely is in blackcurrant oil as well. So I will recommend topical evening primrose and or borage oil. So you, gamma-linolenic acid is a lovely, it's an omega-6 fatty acid. It's not arachidonic acid, so it doesn't cause inflammation. It is a lovely anti-inflammatory, and it does help with pain. It also is a great mood stabilizer. If you have ongoing depression, it can really help with that. So if you take gamma-linolenic acid internally, whether in the form of evening primrose, evening primrose per unit volume seems to have less GLA in it, but sometimes I think it's more effective. And I don't know if it has cofactors in it that make the GLA more bioavailable. However, per unit volume, borage oil has more GLA in it. So you can try either if you're wanting to use that. If you can try borage oil, you can try evening primrose oil, and you use those topically. I did have one patient with lichen sclerosis successfully use both evening primrose oil and silver. She used a form of, it was either colloidal silver or nanoparticle silver, like ACS or silver hydrosol, something, you know, with very low parts per million of silver. So silver can be, you know, those preparations of silver, your colloidal silvers and your silver hydrosols, they can be impressive. They have been shown to do a lot of neat things. And I had a patient who did that, the combination of the GLA and the silver, and that took care of it for her. It was very impressive. So if someone came in with lichen sclerosis, I would have them probably do some combination of the GLA, both internally and topically, some kind of silver, and possibly estriol if they were willing to do it. And also, just your basic calendula cream might do really nicely. Something with calendula cream and calendula in it and comfrey, possibly St. John's wort for healing and also for nerve pain, vitamin E, lavender. So just a really soothing salve might be helpful as well. So that's how we might treat it naturopathically. And the thing that about the naturopathic treatments is, whereas corticosteroids, the issue is they will suppress the inflammation and you'll see your lesions go away. But even your gynecologist and your dermatologist are going to tell you, you can't use these things indefinitely because they're going to thin your skin. If you use gamma linolenic acid and you use calendula cream, that's not going to happen at all. Calendula cream encourages the rebuilding of your skin. And you can use them indefinitely. They're very safe and they're nourishing to your skin. They're putting stuff into your skin that's actually helpful for it. Vitamin E and calendula. And if there's olive oil in it, that's helpful too. These are all things you could eat. And so you put them on your skin, it's really no problem. They're just nourishing and healing as opposed to, suppressing inflammation. So that's lichen sclerosis. It's a pretty uncomfortable condition. There's a bunch of ways to treat it. There's a lot of women who have it, and it's really worth talking about. So, all right. So let me see. I have I just have 9 more minutes of Radio Naturopath today. I want to talk about hot flashes, but I think that deserves a lot more time. So I think what I'd rather do. Give you some ideas about some neat food to eat. So let me think about what's going on right now. This is a wonderful time of year for produce. So I want to remind you again, yay Michael Pollan, who says eat food, not too much, mostly plants. So this is a great time of year to eat mostly plants. And so it's a good idea to find different neat ways to get those greens into you, to find nice salads and stuff, to go to your different farmers markets and try different things, see if you can try something new. Sauteing can be just such an easy thing to do if you're like, I don't want to take time to cook a lot of stuff, but I do like, I would like something besides a salad. All right. So you can get a nice green. You can get some Swiss chard, which is out right now, or you can get a heavier green like a kale. You can get some mustard greens, or you can get callaloo. Any of those things. If you don't feel like cutting it, you can tear it up. I had a companion naturopathic college, a friend of mine. He didn't like to use a knife on greens because he felt like using the knife. First of all, it was a bit of a violent act, and. Also, when you tear the leaves, you're interacting with them more directly. So, and it's when you tear them up, it makes it so that they're easier to eat because, you know, you don't want to shove a very large leaf in your mouth. So you have to break them down somehow. So he would just very intimately tear up the leaves and put them into his salad. You can tear up the leaves gently. You have to decide if you want to eat the stems or not, because you can eat stems. If you saute them enough, they will get tender and you can eat them. And with stems, so say you have a Swiss chard and has a nice long stem, the stems are very good for you. I mean, they have fiber and they have a lot of nutrients. They're where the plant pulls nutrients up from the ground. So you might as well eat them. And that I would probably take a knife to and chop it up. So you have little pieces and then they can be a little crunchy and flavorful. And you can take those lovely greens and then you can take a little bit of garlic. And if you have a little garlic press, you can press it down, or you can take a clove and just chop it up, throw that in, toss in a little olive oil, saute, 5 or 10 minutes, you can have sauteed greens. It really doesn't have to be a big deal. And that's the thing about produce. Produce does not have to be a big deal. We have a situation right now where one of the local farms has set up in our parking lot. And I'm not sure how that happened, but there it is. And so on my work break, I went over and I bought me some peaches. Because I'm moving to the country, going to eat me a lot of peaches. I love the peach time of year. And unfortunately, they were out of Connecticut peaches. So they were from Jersey. And that's all right with me because, I remember growing up that the Jersey peaches were pretty awesome. I know you're all thinking, hey, aren't the Georgia peaches the best? Yeah, but, Jersey peaches are fantastic. And, you know, it just came from New Jersey. It's not so far. And I have to tell you, I had a Jersey peach yesterday that I got, and it was phenomenal. So yay, Jersey peaches, and yay, peach time of year. There's so many things you can do with peaches. So here's a wacky thing that I do. I don't eat a lot of bread. And if you're a person that likes your bread, okay, so eat your bread. It's fine. But for whatever reason, you're still eating a fair bit of bread. But I try not to eat too much bread because, I try to watch my carbs, and I do try to eat a lot of produce. So what happens to yummy peanut butter and jelly sandwiches? So again, bear with me. This is a thing I like to do. If I want to have a cool snack, there's so much great fruit out right now. I'm watching my carbs. I figure it's better if I'm going to have carbs, it's better for me to have fruit than a bunch of bread, because when I eat the fruit, I'm going to get more of a variety of nutrients. I'm going to get a lot more antioxidants. I'm going to get a lot of trace minerals. If I'm eating berries, which I love to eat, so you've got your blueberries, your raspberries, your blackberries, your strawberries. Strawberries are sort of on the way out right now, but they're still coming in from far away, but I think our local strawberry season is about done. But we certainly got blueberries right now, and we certainly got raspberries, and we've got wild raspberries and blackberries too. So those are in high season right now, and you can get cherries. The cherries may not be so local. And I love all these things. So what I will do is I'll take those fruits, and I'll take a handful of each, and I'll put them in a bowl. And then I'll layer some nut butter over them. So I'll get the fresh ground almond butter I'll get the fresh ground almond butter. You can get it. There's a couple of stores in town that you can get fresh ground almond butter. I might use honey roasted peanut butter. I might use some sunflower butter. Yum, yum, yum. I might use a tiny little spoonful of Nutella. And I cover the fruit in that, and I stir it around a little bit, and then I just eat the fruit covered in nut butter. So instead of having jam, I have actual fruit with no added sugar. And instead of having the carbs in the bread, I just have the fruit. And it's great. It's super high in fiber. Makes you regular. It's really good that way. And I just sit there with a bowl, and I eat it like that. And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful snack, and I enjoy it at least as much as I might a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And I just don't eat the bread. And, you can increase your satisfaction by increasing the amount of nut butter you put on. You want to eat enough that you get you're going to get your monounsaturated fats and your fiber from the nuts. And, but you don't want to eat so much that then you get into a calorie situation. And if you're very active right now, you're not going to get into as much of a calorie situation with nut butter as you are with more concentrated starches and sugars. The thing with nut butters is they do have fat in them. You're probably not going to absorb all of the fat in them because they have so much fiber in them, and they're really low in sugar. They're much higher in fat and protein than they are in carbohydrates. So if there's 100 calories in a tablespoon, but there's about 90, 95 calories in a tablespoon of almond butter that doesn't have any sugar added to it. Remember that those calories, when you say there's 95 calories, what that means is that's the amount of calories it would take to burn that almond butter to ash. It doesn't tell you how it's going to behave in your body. So the net calories that's going to happen in your body is probably a good bit less than that because of the fiber. The fiber is going to sweep out a lot of that oil, and you're not going to absorb the oil 100%. The other thing is that when you do absorb the oil, it's monounsaturated fat. You're not going to use all of it as stored energy. You're going to use it for structure. So anything that's used for structure, that lowers the caloric content of it as well. And this is one of the ways that you distinguish how different foods behave in your body. So a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie because of what, 100 calories of a food means. 100 calories of sugar, yes, all of that is going to be either used for energy or stored as fat. But 100 calories of a piece of fruit, 100 calories of something with fiber in it, 100 calories of something with fiber and fat in it, no. The effective amount of calories could be, I don't know what the reduction is, but it's certainly not going to be, it's certainly not going to be 100%. You're probably looking at as much as, you can take off 20 to 25% in terms of those calories. If you eat an isocaloric diet, one that has lots of fruits and vegetables and fiber and protein in it, and you eat that same diet with the same number of calories, but you eat processed food and processed starch and little protein and healthy fats, who do you think is going to lose weight and who do you think is going to gain weight? Of course, the one who eats the healthier diet is going to have a better result. All right. So that's Radio Naturopath 179 on today, August 1st, 2018. Happy birthday, Jerry Garcia. May the four winds blow you safely home. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM.